Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the National Football League has a whole lot of problems. Its finances are most definitely not one of them. The Securities and Exchange Commission thinks small. And our series, American Futures, goes to Allentown, PA. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 11th of September. Good as always to have you here, everybody. CBS Sports will start to get the payoff from its Thursday night investment in the National Football League this evening. The broadcaster paid the NFL $275 million for the rights to Thursday night games this season, the first of which is tonight, Steelers at Baltimore. There are, as you know, many things wrong with the NFL right now. The concussion problem, the bullying case from a year ago, and its actions on domestic violence. As former FBI Director Robert Mueller begins his investigation into who knew what when about the Ray Rice video, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports there is one thing that the NFL is really good at, making gobs and gobs of money.
Percy Harvin, inside the 30. He's going to go. Touchdown, Seattle.
This year's Super Bowl was the most watched program on U.S. TV ever. So if a brand wants to play with the big boys in sports, it pretty much has to play with the NFL. Andrew Zimblist is an economist at Smith College.
The NFL stands out in all of the different revenue sources, and not just by a little bit, but by leaps and bounds over the other sports.
Ticket sales, TV rights, and a whole lot of NFL-logoed official branding and merchandising bring in more than $9 billion. Players endorsing shoes and credit cards generates billions more. Fantasy football betting's taking off, too. But is football's value to the Gatorades and Marriotts and FedExes of the world at risk from recent controversies?
Because it is the most popular spectator sport in the United States, it derives a certain amount of insulation from some of the social criticisms that it receives.
But why is it so popular? After all, the ball's only in play 20 minutes in a three-hour broadcast. Jonathan Taplin at the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab says there's the violence that appeals to a desirable male demographic, then there's the pacing.
Football is actually a perfect collective viewing experience because it's actually the time between the plays where people can discuss things, get a beer.
Another attraction to marketers, far fewer games than baseball or basketball, so the audience is heavily concentrated in those weekend time slots. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Twitter went public 10 months ago, raised almost $2 billion for itself in the process, but has now decided that wasn't enough, apparently. The company said this week it's going to be hitting up that other, more staid source of capital, the debt market, bonds, to the tune of as much as $1.5 billion. How come? Here's Stan Alcorn.
Twitter's war chest is about to go from full to overflowing. It's looking to add at least $1.3 billion to its coffers by selling convertible bonds. So what's the grand strategy for all that cash?
I don't think it's so much what is the big strategy. I think the question many people will be asking is there a really meaningful strategy?
That's the skeptical voice of Nate Elliott, analyst at Forrester. He points out that Twitter has a user base that's closer to Google Plus than Facebook, and it still isn't profitable.
If Twitter's revenues matched its notoriety, it'd be doing just fine.
But bond market investors are not in a skeptical mood, says David Krause, finance professor at Marquette University.
Well, companies are raising record amounts of debt right now.
For a pretty simple reason. With near zero interest rates, other options are slim pickings, which is not a happy economic indicator, according to Wells Fargo's Brian Railing.
It's the result of an economy that is still struggling, and it's also, I think, due to what we're seeing globally.
See the stagnant economy of Europe. But on the plus side?
I think there is a sense from some that this is not going to last.
Finance professor David Krause agrees.
So it's a very opportune time for companies that may not be investment grade to be able to go out and lock in on some long-term money at very attractive rates.
He thinks Twitter won't have any trouble locking in that money, even if all it's buying in the short term is more time. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
After a slow start in lower Manhattan, traders tried and tried and tried all day. Two out of three indices did finally make it back into the green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Securities and Exchange Commission has announced that it's charged nearly 36 people and companies with wrongdoing. The offenses were, for the most part, pretty low level, missing filing deadlines or failing to disclose stock trades by company insiders. The biggest fine was $150,000 and represents somewhat of a change of heart by the new head of enforcement at the SEC. It's known as a broken windows policy, the idea that if you crack down on the little infractions, you're more likely to deter big-time crime. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
Andrew Cerezny is the director of enforcement at the SEC. He says the charges announced yesterday are part of a wider policy the agency adopted about a year ago.
Focusing on these violations does keep people on notice that we are going to bring actions in connection with violations, big and small.
He says the SEC has developed digital tools to allow it to go after these smaller cases without distracting it from bigger ones. And it's those bigger cases of fraud that the agency needs to win. Tom Gorman is a partner with the law firm Dorsey & Whitney. He points to misses like the Madoff Ponzi scheme and the public's perception that the SEC hasn't netted a big fish in the wake of the financial crisis.
They haven't really brought a recently a huge financial fraud case, but they've brought some. It's those kinds of cases that are going to build their reputation to what they want it to be.
Yesterday's settlements might cause some companies to look at their filing policies, says Michael Rivera. He's the chair of the Securities Enforcement and Compliance Practice at Venable LLP. But he doubts these smaller cases will deter bigger criminals.
The individuals that are going to engage in massive frauds, I don't think are too worried about these smaller cases that are going on. I think the real way for the SEC to deter major frauds like that is to go after those major frauds.
The SEC thinks it can do both. It says it wants investors to know there's a strong cop on the beat, not just someone sitting in the station waiting for a call. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's a bunch of stuff Congress has on its plate in the next week or so. Before they adjourn to go home and campaign to keep their jobs, lawmakers have to figure out how they want to vote on the president's plan to deal with ISIS. They have to agree on a plan to keep the government up and running come October the 1st. And that's even without counting the big stuff like immigration and tax reform. It is a lot, especially when you work a three-day week. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
All right. First of all, I want to thank everybody for being here today.
Congressman Rick Nolan is standing behind a podium outside the Capitol. The Minnesota Democrat unveiled legislation this week that would make Congress do something radical. Stay in Washington 5 days a week.
As many of you know, I served back in the 70s.
Yeah, he said the 70s. Nolan first served in Congress from 1975 to 81. More than three decades later, he ran again and won. A lot has changed on Capitol Hill. For one, political pros now tell members of Congress they need to spend 30 hours a week raising money when they're in Washington. Nolan says they never had to do that before, and they were in Washington Monday through Friday. Now, Nolan says, members breeze in for just 3 days, usually Tuesday through Thursday.
But with everybody flying in and flying out for three nights and a day and a half of work, I mean, it's an absurdity.
But some members of Congress say, hey, we need those long weekends home in our districts. We're still working, holding meetings with constituents. Deb Detmers is district director for Congressman John Shimkus, a Republican from Illinois. She says sometimes when she's driving the congressman around in the district, they listen to talk radio and roll their eyes.
And, you know, you'll hear something on the radio about, you know, these guys are the do-nothing Congress and they're back home on vacation. And, you know, you picked him up at 6:30 that morning and it's 7 o'clock at night.
Congressman Nolan says, yes, district work is important, but why not come to Washington for 3 weeks straight, then take a week in your district? If Congress were a company with these types of conflicts, it would turn to someone like corporate efficiency expert Daniel Markovitz, president of Markovitz Consulting. Markovitz says if Congress were his client,
I would throw up my hands in despair.
But after he gets over the shock of thinking of the government as a corporation, Markovitz has an idea. More face-to-face time for warring Republicans and Democrats.
If I were running a business that had two factions, whether it's the East Coast office and the West Coast office, if I were trying to bridge a divide like that, I would think that face-to-face time is absolutely essential.
Markovitz says maybe members of Congress could even socialize with each other. Congressman Nolan says he did go camping and hunting with other representatives back in the day, but he doesn't have anybody to hang out with now.
And, you know, you hear people say, ah, the members of Congress need to go out and have a pop or a beer together. Hell, we just need to come and work together to start with.
But you have to remember, the writers of Congress's corporate charter, the Constitution, they didn't want Congress to be efficient. They wanted democracy to be messy and slow, with lots of debate. Not exactly what a lean corporation needs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
When people start talking about inequality in the American economy, there are two big ways that they do it. There's a wealth gap, you hear that a lot, and there's an income gap. They are not, however, the same thing. Income is what you make and usually spend. Wealth is what you save. And generally speaking, the rich don't get to be rich by spending. So as a business proposition, if you're a retailer, how do you get the wealthy to tap into some of that wealth? Sally Herships reports.
Rich people spend money very differently than the rest of us.
You don't really typically see movie stars walking into the grocery store to pick up milk. They have a handler.
Kirby Rosbach is author of The Complete Family Office Handbook and a fourth-generation member of a family business.
So it would be accurate to categorize you as wealthy?
I guess it depends on who's categorizing me. Because I'm not wealthy, you know, compared to a Warren Buffett or a Carl Icahn.
You and I may be worried about our retirement, but Rosbach says the ultra-wealthy are saving their money for something else.
They have to determine what they want for their lifestyle today and what they want for their legacy when they're not here.
Money for grandchildren, a charity, or an alma mater. And after 2008, Rosbach says the wealthy are also likely to be more conservative with spending. She says marketers can get the rich wrong.
The biggest mistake I see is marketers trying to play into the stereotype of who they think these people are.
To try and appeal to the wealthy as a group is not a winning strategy.
Andrew Sachs helps companies target affluent consumers. He says about 90% of rich Americans didn't grow up wealthy, so affluent shoppers can be intimidated by fancy schmancy stores.
There's a lot on the line. You know, when you're buying a $500,000 diamond, you really don't want to be the fool and buy that thing that's the wrong thing.
Which is one reason Sachs says it's important for luxury brands to educate consumers on the brand's history, product quality. He says when you buy a luxury product with a high price tag, it can start to feel totally normal.
So you might buy Tom Ford shoes for the first time and feel like, holy cow, I just spent $1,600 on these shoes. I really went overboard. Well, that becomes your new floor.
First of all, is that how much Tom Ford shoes cost?
I'm embarrassed to say it is.
Are you wearing those shoes?
I am.
They're very nice.
Thank you.
And thank you is what Andrew Sachs says luxury brands need to say a lot more. He says as we live longer than ever and have a lot of stuff, it becomes more important for brands to learn how to connect with consumers on a personal level. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Allentown deserved a different place than that song ever put us in.
American Futures goes to Allentown, and no, we are not going to play that Billy Joel song. Thank you very much. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 19 points today, a 10th percent, closed at 17,049. The NASDAQ up 5 points, a 10th percent, 45.91. The S&P 500 gained a point less than a 10th percent, ended things at 1997. Twitter, we told you about its debt sale, right? Shares down about a 0.5%. Google gave back more than a 3% today. Radio Shack, remember them? Radio Shack said it may have to file for bankruptcy protection if its cash situation gets too much worse, but it's in talks to shore up that situation, and shares in the Shack were up more than 9% today. That's a lot of S's. Verizon shares up more than a 0.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.54%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday.
In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for August. The popular television program Lassie premiered 60 years ago. The show transitioned from black and white to color in its 11th season. And he just won an Emmy for television writing. Comedian Louis C.K. turns 47. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are going to be two cultural touchstones in this next story. The latest installment of the series we've been working on with Jim Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his wife Deb, in which they fly around the country in their own small plane, seeing what they can see with us joining in along the way. It is, at its essence, a rediscovery of the American economy, and we call it American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, got Tango for landing.
Touchstone number one is a song. You've heard it or heard of it. It's by Billy Joel, about a town where the factories were all closed and the best days were long gone by. No, we're not going to make you listen to it. It is, of course, a song about Allentown, Pennsylvania, right in the heart of the Lehigh Valley. Touchstone number two is a film about baseball, Field of Dreams. And to paraphrase here for just a bit, the idea that if you build it, they will come.
And now, the starting lineup for your Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs!
We're at Coca-Cola Park, home of the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs.
Lee Boots runs his family's business in Allentown. It's a construction company called Alvin H. Boots Incorporated.
We're down to the sixth generation, and we've been here the whole time, and we've been building all kinds of things from covered bridges to hospitals and athletic facilities.
Coca-Cola Park is a little gem of a ballpark, really. 8,000 seats for the Philadelphia Phillies AAA farm team, the aforementioned Iron Pigs.
It took 14 months to build. It cost $50
million. 55-0?
5-0, 50 million.
By the time this stadium opened in 2008, Allentown had been dying a long and slow and painful death. Downtown was empty. Businesses and people had long since left for the suburbs, even Alvin H. Boots Incorporated.
In 1972, we moved from Allentown to the suburbs. Almost everyone was moving out of the center city. And in a couple of decades, it became so severe that many people thought downtown Allentown would never survive.
And then the Iron Pigs came to town.
There was a lot of people who said, the Lehigh Valley will never support minor league baseball, but it is the best attended minor league ballpark in the country for several years.
They built it, and people came. So Lee Boots and his sons decided to come back too.
The community has been so good to us that we just felt that what's the best way we could pay the community back? Let's go to downtown Allentown and see whether it makes a difference, see whether a lot of people will follow us downtown.
The first 5 years you were downtown, though, it was a little rough.
It was more than a little rough. We thought maybe we made a terrible mistake. We occupied two floors of our six-story building, and we hardly had any other tenants. And we thought, oh, my gosh, we can't make this work. But then along came the NIS. It has 180 degrees changed our downtown.
Pat Brown, State Senate, 16th District, Pennsylvania.
Pat Brown, the father of the NIS, the Neighborhood Improvement Zone, isn't really much of a Billy Joel fan, at least when it comes to that song.
Personally, I never liked it, but I guess if I had to define it for me, it was somewhat of an inspiration to turn things around because Allentown deserved a different place than that song ever put us in.
It was an inspiration for him to draft a piece of legislation, the NIS, that would help fix up his hometown.
You need to give investors an additional incentive in a challenged neighborhood to choose that challenged neighborhood over what has been the successful development in the suburbs.
Tax incentives, basically. Big, big tax incentives to convince developers they won't lose their shirts if they decide to build in the economically damaged heart of downtown Allentown. All of which is to say that before the NIS, spending $50 million on that baseball stadium was a big risk. Now, with it in place, Allentown is betting on another sport, hockey. And it's raised the stakes just a little bit to a cool $1 billion.
There's a million square feet of development in the arena block. Between the hotel, the office, the retail, the arena itself, and about 900 parking spaces. About $350 million of cost just in the arena block alone.
J.B. Riley is the guy who's doing all that developing.
And you're from here, basically, right?
I am.
Tell me what it was like here when you were a kid.
Well, when I was a kid back in the 70s, downtown Allentown was still a retail center. You know, all the banks were headquartered here. All the law firms were here. All the brokerage houses were here. It was a pretty dynamic place. But there was a migration to the suburbs. The big driver here in Allentown was the creation of the Whitehall Mall. Slowly, you started seeing the out-migration of retail from the downtown. And I think we kind of hit bottom maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Riley made his fortune building suburban sprawl. But just like Lee Boots, he's come back downtown as well. $600 million spent, $400 million more on the books.
Well, look at this.
Yeah,
it's an arena.
So the arena is 8,500 seats right now.
The centerpiece is an office complex and Marriott Hotel built around a state-of-the-art arena.
There literally is not a bad seat in the house, particularly for concerts.
That's the bet, because tomorrow night, the arena built for the Lehigh Valley Phantoms, the minor league franchise of the Philadelphia Flyers, is going to host the first event of its kind Allentown has seen in decades, a sold-out concert by the Eagles. Riley's got construction workers going around the clock because he knows getting the arena done isn't just about the concert.
There'll be 3,000 more people working here next month than there were a year ago. 3,000. And that, you know, for a city like Allentown, that's just extraordinary. Some may say, well, you know, it's an expensive project. It's a lot. There's a lot of state subsidy in the project, you know, and there is. But I think, you know, what's it worth to turn around the third largest city in the state of Pennsylvania?
Not a bad question, right? What is it worth? And what's going to happen to the city once it gets turned around?
This is 7th Street. Allentown is in the middle of the kind of downtown.
Julio Garrido, the president of the Allentown City Council, shows us around his old neighborhood. It's not more than 4, maybe 5 blocks from Riley's project.
Most of the businesses located here are primarily Latinos, Hispanics, but there is also a number of Ethiopians, Arabs, Puerto Ricans, Americans, Koreans, you name it.
As the locals moved out to the suburbs, immigrants moved into downtown, led by Garrido's generation 40 years ago.
The big influx came about 10 years ago. So it's still a fairly new community. Many of them transferred from another place with a Section 8 voucher. Some of them transferred with a welfare check.
Allentown is now almost 50% Hispanic.
So we were talking this morning about that project that they got going on. And I just want to know how these people get a part of that action.
Well, that's the multi-million dollar question.
Zach Alali has owned a Five and Dime here in town for a decade or so. He's stocking his shelves as we chat.
So if you go 4 blocks down the road, right, they're spending $1 billion. Are you going to see any of that money?
I hope so. Bringing more customers, more traffic to the city.
You think it's going to work?
Yeah. You think they're going to dump, what, $200 million for nothing? They're not stupid. They know what they're doing.
Is it better here now than it was 10 years ago?
It's getting better. But we need the city to be a little bit more involved in the businesses, small businesses.
City's pretty involved with the big business.
So we are the underdogs.
Do you feel that? You feel that every day?
Yeah, I feel it every day.
It worked in the movie, right? That whole if you build it, he will come thing. But in real life, can a city build its way out of economic despair? I don't know. Allentown's only got those 6 square blocks under development out of 18 square miles inside the city limits. And they're only 2 years into a 30-year plan. But for State Senator Pat Brown, it is right now all about that Eagles concert tomorrow night.
What's it going to be like when 10,000 people come to downtown Allentown? That hasn't happened in a good long while.
Leading up to that event that night, I'm not going to spend my time inside the arena. I'm going to be standing outside looking at the waves of people coming downtown and seeing something that I haven't seen as a resident of Allentown in 30 years. And that's going to feel really good.
There is more from our trip to Allentown on our website. Also, Jim Fallow's blog about our series, American Futures in the Atlantic. It is all at marketplace.org. 'Cause it's a long road ahead.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today. You know how people have started sneezing and coughing into their elbows instead of their hands because public health types convinced us that would reduce the spread of germs? Yeah, prepare to say goodbye to the handshake as we know it. A study in the American Journal of Infection Control compared handshakes to fist bumps to high fives as germ transition mechanisms. Turns out we would all be a lot healthier if there was more fist bumping going on. I'm just saying. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace on this Thursday. Today, the Dow off 19 points. That's about a 10%. The NASDAQ gained 5. That is a 10%. The S&P 500 put on a point. That is less than a 10%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Kim Bowie, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.